Etsy, I'm using transparency, not because somebody stole my laptop yesterday at the airport. I was going to use transparency anyway because I just learned about that I'm supposed to give a talk maybe a couple of weeks ago. I didn't know what I was going to talk about. But the relation of mathematics to the physical world, as you will see, I'm trying to sketch in my talk. It's a vast subject that is always my favorite subject. And it actually touches from the foundation of everything to technological problems. And I will try to talk about all of them. I was thinking about maybe I should pick one or two subjects and talk about them in depth. But I found there are two things. One is that this is the kind of things I don't see that is discussed in, that I haven't seen in books or papers. And so it is also in a technical talk, I found that if I lose something, then I cannot really keep following what is going on. And I think, therefore, it is better that I give a very broad and a wide survey. So you may find no sense out of this, but hopefully, maybe you find a few words that may stimulate your further thinking. So, what? Right here, so I should see it from this way, that would be fine. We all know that Wigner said that there is unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics in physics. And why is mathematics so powerful to describe what we apply to the real world? And actually, I'm interested in a relation of mathematics as it relates to all sorts of reality. I mean, not just physical, but mathematical reality, let's say, is of a separate kind. And then we are interested in its relation to physical reality, to conditional mental reality, for example. And I think, in a most general way, that is the problem of human knowledge or philosophy to knowledge. Throughout history, that is, how do we connect our internal representations to external reality? Now, I want to talk about four separate topics. The first one is the basic foundational one. Language and interpretation is like mathematical language, first order language, and I'm talking about, in, say, the mathematical sense and how that is related to the physical world or to other kinds of reality. Then I will talk about the meaning and representation. Meaning is the meaning of natural language, usually. How we can capture the meaning of a natural language sentence and actually represent them correctly. And now, when we come, then I will come to more mundane issues. That is, how complete mathematical representation is for a specific problem, and in particular, how robust it is, how sensitive it is to small disturbances. And that connects a lot with the problem of quantum information. I guess one can say that after 15 years, or especially since Peter Shor's algorithm came out, and that has been a huge amount of activity in experimental work in quantum information. And why is it seems that we have not even progressed very far experimentally? So I'll try to see how that may relate to it. And then last topic is actually in a mathematical proof, mathematical guarantee of the kind of problems we look at, especially in cryptography type of problems, but others too. What are the meaning, actually empirical meaning of the theory we have? So all of these are connected actually from the very basic to the very practical. That's what I want to look into. Maybe to give you an introduction to what kind of why I'm puzzled or really interested in this. Is, I guess, when I was in high school, I first heard of the mathematical theorem that you can prove with straight edge and compass. You cannot bisect an arbitrary angle or some angle, and you cannot square the circle, so on and so forth. And what struck me as, well, you know, trigonometry, geometry, and so on, you can see why, you know, that can be applied to making a building or measuring the pyramids or so on. But I don't understand how you can prove you cannot do something with some other things where you, I don't even know how to, why they are all represented, straight edge and compass. And that is how the mathematics, how can we have sure certain knowledge of something like that? And how can we capture all possible operations with straight edge and compass? And later, of course, I found that it's a huge catch in doing this. Actually, not only the straight edge doesn't have marks on it, you have a lot of restrictions on what you can do with the compass. And actually, it's really an algebraic thing. I mean, the usual proof that you cannot do that. And then you have some interpreted in terms of some straight edge and compass operation, but it is really not correct to say that with just straight edge and compass. In fact, Archimedes gave a way to do that. And to me, it looks like that's just exactly using a straight edge and compass. But why then it is impossible? That's the kind of problems that I motivate me in looking at it. I think the first time I talked about something about mathematics with physics is actually in the 06 QCMC. And I think actually maybe even a little bit in 08 and so on has always been my main interest intellectually. So foundational reference to reality. One of them, of course, I'm just talking some topics arbitrary. What's the physical meaning of you? We are using mathematics. So they are mathematical axioms, axiom of choice. Countable sets, uncountable sets, uncountable axiom of choice. What meaning could it have? Could it possibly have physically? And of course, we usually use real numbers. We use real numbers all the time. So I don't think there is going you can do physics with, without real numbers in general formulations. Maybe you can say that, oh, we use a digital computer to solve it. But we formulate all our theories, general relativity, quantum field theory. All the axioms are on very high level mathematics using real numbers. And we derive general properties of the system from them. So we cannot just digitize. But of course, we all know that the real number is an infinite construction. So from any of the mathematical definitions we have, for a real number. So we have infinity incarnate in the real number. How does that real number connect to reality? When we make a measurement, we don't measure an arbitrary real number. We measure a rational number, which is only a ratio of two integers. Maybe you make inference on it and call that and say that there's some real number. And I say that one effect of this real number shows up very crucially in the following under fundamental theorem in communication theory. And I think it is actually of very crucial importance in physics. It's that if we model a signal, a time-varying signal, as a real value function of time, then we define the time duration and frequency duration, which is the bandwidth, a very important basic concept. And now there is no signal which is, I mean, bandwidth is frequency Fourier transform of the real-time signal, and then we have the duration. If we look at it as something which is strictly time-limited, then it cannot be strictly band-limited. It can, in fact, cannot vanish on any compact set at the Fourier transform because of the analytic properties. And the same thing for time. If you have a strictly band-limited system, of course, you have time-limited, cannot be strictly time-limited. But how can it be physically, you see? Don't we have physically a finite time all the time? The age of the universe is finite. Frequency, how high a frequency you can have it? So how can it be not finite? And if we define So this is some sort of a problem for describing reality with strictly time-limited and strictly band-limited signal. And if we define any approximate, some approximate measure in various different ways, then we have the dimensionality theorem, which tells you that actually the signal space, the linear signal space that is expanded by time and band-limited functions of time duration, say T and W, is roughly 2dW, which of course is the same as sampling. It can have a slightly different multiplying constant and slightly additive constant. So this is one, I think, one way that the use of real numbers, which is not, has no direct correspondence with the physical world, I think shows up this problem. And so the dimensionality theorem would lead to a digitization of it in one way, and I think quantum physics actually would do it in another way. I think in 02, I was going to talk about the proving mathematical theorems with physics. I think you may think I'm crazy. I actually wrote up the talk for this the Feynman conference, and then I switched to another subject for various reasons. So the basic idea is the following, I think, is that the mathematical symbols interpretation is usual interpretation in set theory, set theoretic models. But of course, we can, if you take reality, physical reality is also a model. And so there is the mathematics and its reference to a model is what is being referred to. And I don't want to go into exactly how this. I have one or two examples of how I think it's actually one can use a physical argument to show that a mathematical relation must hold. There are some other common problems, of course, the meaning of probability. Subjective, objective, whatever, and so on. And before I want to lead into the next topics, I'm talking about meaning representation from the foundation through that. In classical and quantum physics, I think that probability, I would like to call, why didn't I say epistemological? Yeah, I say there's a fundamental difference of the probability in classical and quantum physics. In classical physics, I would call epistemic probability, that you don't know what's going on. And quantum mechanically, actually, is an ontological thing. And people say that when the quantum mechanics come along, and still the philosopher of scientists still talk about that, we have a quantum mechanics, if you want to take it seriously, means something, idealism, some sort of if you don't look at it, there is no reality yet. And that can be traced to what in the Western philosophy tradition, so I think these are Berkeley, they call Berkeley, it's Berkeley, but every philosopher I heard call it Berkeley in the early 17th century. The slogan is to be perceived. And that kind of philosophy actually has been known, is explicitly described in detail in India, I think, for thousands of years. And that, they think they don't like it because it's physical physicists. They're talking about actual real things, not talk about, not about things which is constructed by phenomena. However, in my opinion, I think that any of this does not render quantum physics well enough. I think quantum physics has a totally radically different ontology never discussed in the history of philosophy. So something totally new needs to be described. And recently, I complete some other things and found that, you see, to me, infinite things, even countably infinite, has no physical meaning. I don't know what its physical meaning is, at least. And however, I find that in the usual mathematical description, even a countable and uncountable infinite make a huge difference in a problem that I looked into and about physics, about whether you can have supernumeral communication. And that thing seems extremely strange to me because In the past, my idea of even uncountable, all of this are coming from the set theory axioms, they are illusions. For example, the Skolem paradox or the downward Löwenheim Skolem theorem would tell you that if you have any set theory model, you have a countable model. Why would this countable and uncountable infinite make any difference in physics? It's something very strange. And of course, the problems I was talking about before, where does the power of quantum computation come in, or dense coding, super dense coding, especially whether they can be done carried out classically. So this is all the problem of reality, what reality is, how they are described, what a mathematical representation captures. So meaning of representation. One problem is how do you capture all the some concepts expressed by ordinary language completely? When I was a research associate at MIT 35 years ago, and I went to many philosophy seminars. That's one of my main interests, and they always focused at those days, I probably even now, the Anglo-American tradition is in theory of meaning. See, how do you describe what meaning is? How can you characterize it? And they like to pretend to be the philosophers, to be scientific by use the notations of first order logic as much as possible. However, of course, they all conclude that we cannot. I mean, in a general way, if you just write down a sentence, you cannot characterize, capture its meaning. You cannot represent the meaning of almost anything precisely. So in the context of physics, we will have how there is the problem how we characterize various things. How do you know that we characterize a single instance of it? How do we know that we characterize all instances? And first of all, the cloning procedure, even something as simple as that, I think there is almost no controversy. Everybody believes that there's the low cloning theorem is true. You cannot just clone things exactly quantum mechanically. But I believe that's true, of course, but I think that the exactly complete proof is not the way it is usually presented. Then, the next level problems, how do we characterize an attack in cryptographic problems? And I don't want to talk about that. Then the local hidden variable theory is a big problem. As you could see that von Neumann has claimed that he ruled out, he said hidden variable theories are impossible. He gave a proof of it, except that supposedly David Bohm and whoever produced local hidden variable theory. And of course, von Neumann proved a correct mathematical theorem. It's just that he assumes that the local hidden variable theory has to obey this linearity condition that is not obeyed in the other, in Bohm's theory. But is it a hidden variable theory? Nowadays, I think recently there is a controversy about whether Bell's inequality violates locality or local thing. From somebody from this institute, I don't remember. So I read a lot of disputes with various people about whether he actually. He claimed that he proved Bell is wrong, that Bell does not prove quantum mechanics is not local. So a lot of this has to do with what exactly one means by.
Well, also, the implication that quantum mechanics is interpretation of quantum mechanics.
Who?
Dave Deutsch and Patrick Hayden.
Yeah, I
know. And that's a kind of a local. A very massive local hidden variable explanation of.
So do they consider that as a violation of Bell's theorem?
No. It's utterly orthodox.
So why then it's all like part of this terminal, this dispute is part of it is the is still on the terminology of what you call local, what you call a hidden variable theory, right? So the way that we've seen construed as Bell's theorem is saying that there's no local hidden variable that can be produced the predictions of quantum mechanics. This guy, I forget his name, claims that he refused it as a theorem. So another way is how do we characterize all mechanical procedures in ordinary classical physics, computer science? That's the Church Turing thesis. It's called a thesis because they don't know how to represent, or they just make a claim that with evidence, of course, it's an argument to claim that, that all mechanical procedures can be represented by Turing machine, whatever, post machines, recursive functions, but they it's not a theorem because it's not cannot they nobody has made a definition on mechanical procedures. Now the same thing for protocols in cryptography. I think that's the point in the for quantum bit commitment QBC. I think Ozawa made this point, brought this point out explicitly that we don't. Nobody, if you claim something is impossible in some in any of this, and you don't have a definition of what that is, so it can at best be a thesis. I guess I don't want to talk about the QVC at all. I believe the poster paper I gave in the 06 almost 2 years ago in the QCMC gives. QVC protocol, the 4-page I wrote down. At some point, I will write a detailed account of it. Then we look at something on the completeness, a mathematical representation for a given problem situation. Now, here I'm getting into something more related to what actually goes on in the practice. I don't want to talk about protocol security, actually. Robustness and small disturbance, there are two. One well-known thing is about the what is called the Schrodinger cat. Of course, you all know that. Why don't we all see the Schrodinger cat in the macroscopic world? Because it, in some sense, it decoheres. It becomes nothing. Becomes not a superposition macroscopically. And there's something similar that happens to what is called the Loon state in quantum metrology. And a number of years ago, actually, there's a group, I think Dowling is the main promoter, claiming that the Loon state is this entanglement of n0, but 0n, photon. Would allow you to get a lot of improvement in signal. Well, one of if you look at one mode, the standard quantum limit is for the when you estimate something, it's 1/√n. If you look using actually three state, you can get 1/n. If you use Loon state, you also get 1/n. If you use the third one. As far as the signal-to-noise ratio goes, that I already pointed out, actually, with stay at the input of the interferometer instead of at the output. I think probably at the output gives something like a Loon state, a similar kind of macroscopic entangled state that gives you a 1/n improvement. However, they propose something more. They claim that the Rayleigh resolution in the interferometer instead of lambda, it also goes in, it's improved by a factor lambda over n. And they, for a long time until I guess maybe a year or two ago, they did not look into this in the presence of small disturbance, like loss. And it turns out that when I was writing probably my first. Is that my first? No, my second.
quantum cryptography paper. I look at the Lewin state, and I try to actually propose to use that for the BB84 type system. And I knew that this kind of system, in analogy of Schrodinger cat, is very sensitive to loss. So I compute the density operator for this and look at the off-diagonal matrix element. You can look at the trace form for that, the difference between a state which is totally uncorrelated. And you find that, as is well known in the Schrodinger cat type literature, in a macroscopic state, if you use one quantum, say an N type, the state decoheres in the sense that off-diagonal matrix element goes down by 1 over E. I mean, that's the typical definitions one uses. Now, so I conclude along that this kind of state is not useful in the real world for large N, because, say, if your N is 1 million photon, you lose 1 photon, you only need the loss of 10 or minus 6. That would, you already lose the, with a very tiny loss system. I call it supersensitivity, which is a bad choice of words because they use the word sensitivity in the opposite sense. So I shouldn't call that supersensitivity. I didn't know they used that word. I call it supersensitivity because I thought in the classical situations, there is something similar, some phenomena. Something is very sensitive to small, some phenomena, some gain to small disturbance. One of them is detection in non-white Gaussian noise. You can get perfect detection if you don't have just a little bit of white component, but in reality, of course, you never do, because it, no matter how small that white component is, it will wipe it out. And in fact, getting resolution beyond the diffraction limit is looking at the Fourier transform relation. You also can get it exactly by looking at a piece of the Fourier transform. You can get the whole thing. But again, any small error would make the whole thing, would just propagate and make the whole thing not work. So, on the other hand, Dowling was able to convince a lot of people to give a lot of funding. And in fact, we are a benefactor. There is a DARPA program now called the Quantum Sensor Project, Phase 1. We are studying the possibility of quantum sensors. And it all originated from the promise, or supposed promise, of the Lewin state. And what is interesting is that I thought the problem could be settled very easily, and I think still could be when you send out the whole state whether entangled or not, and that suffers a lot of loss. And that's what something called, what I call a very simple result called classicalization theorem. Is that you have a state, and we are talking about bosons, right? Infinite dimensions. If it is suffer a lot of loss, then you only need to add a very small amount of Gaussian noise. Say if the loss is gamma, then all you need to add is what is that small amount, gamma, Gaussian noise variance. That would turn it into a classical state. A classical state is one which is a probabilistic random superposition of coherent states. And because it is a random superposition of coherent state, therefore a classical state, that's in quantum optics, is automatically separable. It's no entanglement. So that means if a state, any quantum state that suffers a large loss, is so fragile, it's just like it washes out its quantum feature. Because in quantum optics, we regard, for good reasons, that a quantum state, which is what we call a classical state, a random superposition of coherent states, is essentially a classical field. There's nothing intrinsically quantum mechanical, which is not quite true, but they are quantum mechanical in a different way. So if we do this, we send out this signal, bounce it back, and then suffer huge loss. Why the quantum sensor? Of course, the defense is interested in radar problems, whether you want to detect whether the target is present, you want to measure the target properties, you want to make an image of the target. Actually, I think that's what they are most interested in. So at least to the degree you can differentiate whether, I guess, if it's a tank or a car or whatever. And now, that, I think, would be eliminated by this kind of classicalization in huge loss. On the other hand, actually, the situation is much more complicated in the presence of entanglement. Beyond, to my surprise, is that if you send part of an entangled system beam to hit the target and coming back, and you assume that what you keep is totally free of error. No, it's perfectly, you have perfect quantum memory, you have no loss, and so on. Of course, we cannot do that actually in practice, but in principle, let's say, we at least we are not sending it out. So this part, we can have a lot less disturbance. So in this entangles, can we actually get a lot better, do a lot better? I don't think anybody has found one yet that is convincing in any way. On the other hand, it's much harder to rule out as I originally thought. So I think a loss, in a sense, not just coupling to an other system to lose it, but also especially to be in the sense of within a system, that is within a direct sum Hilbert space type loss, going to another level versus going outside the Hilbert space to another one, is a real trouble in anything quantum mechanical, both of them. And one needs to analyze their effects a lot more, the small effects. What is this problems? QIS and T, I think they already use it, the term or something like that, quantum information science and technology, as if there's already technology here. Now, all the arguments I gave seems to indicate that, I mean, or some of the things I indicated it's difficult to make things work on a large scale like this. But why things don't even work on a small scale experimentally? I have two or three experimental colleagues, very good ones, Van Fulmer, Salim Saria, and Zhang Ho. Especially Saria actually works on quantum computation. Experimentally, I mean, the free experimentally. So I asked them about various questions, and Pam works on things related to optics. I guess they, in their opinion, one cannot generate a single photon. There's no single photon source. On demand means you can get it with a very high probability. And of course, you cannot get it in a well-defined single space-time hole. I mean, it's the photon is somewhere. It doesn't matter. Then you can get it. But one cannot do that. And experimentally, I'm talking about. Experimentally, they cannot generate EVR pair on demand. Same thing that they wanted is a low probability. They have been working on it for many years. I mean, not just them, but the whole community, of course. And they have been working on getting good quantum memory for years for the optically, but nothing really works much better than even if you work very hard, as far as I remember what they tell me, which may not be up to date, is not better than using a fiber, the low loss fiber, 0.2 dB per kilometer. Just prove it in the fiber. And if you look at this, optically, the light just bounces off each on a mirror each time. How small a loss you have? See, if the system is classical, if you look at classical states or means superpositional coherent states, it doesn't really matter how big, whether you loss is 0.1% or even 1%, 0.01%. But quantum mechanically, it makes a huge difference, as you could see from squeezing. So in the case of squeezing, if you have an infinitely squeezed light hitting on a mirror, and then the mirror has 1% loss, 1% reflectivity, then the bounce, when it bounces back, squeezing is down to two orders of magnitude from the standard limit, from the coherent state level. And if it is 99.9%, that is only you lose 0.1%, you get three orders of magnitude squeezing from infinity. And so this is the kind of importance of a loss, how tiny a loss is in the mirror reflectivity. So I asked experimentalists, well, how big you can get a mirror reflectivity? They say, well, you really have to work very hard to get 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 4 per bounce. And maybe if you go to a special, you know, do something special, really do a lot of it, maybe you can push an order of magnitude higher, but they cannot make it if they ever try, seriously. 10 to the minus 6, 10 to the minus 7 per bounce, which would lead to, if you look numbers comparable to looping the light in the lowest loss fiber that we have for the last almost 30 years that has not changed. So the problem is that why can one make a longer quantum memory? This is a not large scale problem. I'm just talking about one small system. Why can we make a complete Bell measurement? A good one. So all this is quantitative, of course, what the numbers, but their numbers are, according to them, are very far from ideal. Why can one build a good control NOT gate? Well, it depends what you mean by good, but in some of their opinion, I mean, I don't want to specify exactly whom, but I think they always say, now they even said that in NSF review panel meeting. So it's not that they are hiding it. They cannot get a good, depends what you mean by good. I think somebody, DeVincenzo or so on, gave the seven characteristics or whatever of a good control NOT gate, and the numbers that people have been able to get, according to them, are not good. So if you don't get good numbers, it will be very difficult to make things work. But why they cannot make it better? Then, because the numbers are pretty bad, I mean, in some of these cases. And I think one reason is related to the system being the mathematical representations that people use to analyze them miss many small effects, like small perturbation Hamiltonian, small little thing. And in even in a small system, when you have quantum effect, small perturbation may lead to huge disruption of what huge in the sense of, you know, give you 10% error. So, so I think that it is the theoretician's job, not the experimenter's job. They can do it. You see, in a usual problem in physics, actually the theorists can look at, do a special, take a theoretical model, analyze the effects, and then the experimentalists, when they compare with the experiments, there are a lot more technical, real details. But the experimentalists actually, especially the better ones, can take them into account and run the theory with them doing the numerical analysis, doing things more detailed than the, at least the first or second predictions by the theories. And they will be able to actually make the system work. However, if you have something like as complicated as this quantum problem, so small disturbance can, it's hard to deal with, actually. You see, when you look at the qubit, I want a direct sum. I want to look at the qubit in the or even the infinite dimensional space, say, a real boson. And so the problem is difficult to deal with, but the experimentalists cannot just do them. And even the theoreticians are reluctant to do them. That's why I think there's no very few results on that. But they have to do that if they want to do, to make things real and to get the experimentalists. Cannot just say that I use an ideal model. I predict this effect. Okay, why don't you go to the lab and view it? And the experimentalists cannot view it. It's not their fault because the model is, first of all, it's very difficult to do because a lot of the requirements are very stringent. Secondly, it's because you have not given them a sufficiently complete model that includes all the small disturbances that may help them to see how they may be able to do that, to find a region where they can operate it. So I think the theoreticians should do need to do something more real in this quantum case, because the nature of the quantum problem that I'm saying is different from usual physics problems, that sensitivity to small disturbance. Significance of mathematical guarantee. I want to look at what is the operational meaning of a quantitative statement here I'm talking about. Operational meaning, I mean, you can take it in a philosophical sense or take it in the everyday sense. It just means that what it means, you know, when people actually are doing things. One simple thing is asymptotic versus finite. Asymptotic results with everybody's, a lot of theoreticians are working on, because that's the relatively easy thing to do. But in reality, everything is finite. In fact, I heard a lot of my computer science and engineering colleagues telling me all this computer science algorithm theory are useless for them, because they need algorithms that work for their real problem with the real parameters. It's not asymptotic. It's nothing to do with for those performances. And then there's, of course, the problem of what a proof means and how, whether the proof is validated. And my previous student, Max Wojcinski, sent me a paper less than a year ago, actually, 9 months ago, a paper by Koblis on the uneasy relations between mathematics and cryptography. He was, Koblis, of course, is the guinea pig curve guy, and working with somebody here in the University of Waterloo, cryptography, real important. And he was talking about how in that, he published a lot of technical paper. That was this American Mathematical Society sort of paper. And he was talking about, of course, classical RSA, public key, the meaning of, he also mentioned asymptotic and finite, the difference, and what it means completely meaningless, the asymptotic results in the actual world. And he talked about the meaning of those relative security proofs, the relative, you assuming one problem is hard. And he talks about that the proofs are not read based on, I guess, authority, and sometimes turn out to be wrong and have pretty bad consequence. And now, and I think they all of this apply at least as much and more in the different ways in the quantum arena. Operational meaning of entropy in cryptography is something very specific, so I would spend some time talking about a little bit of time, which I talked about them before, and I think I wrote down maybe even a page on it in the last, in the QCMC, in last, the last one. But I think it is another good illustration of the general point here. What is the meaning of your theory in relation to an actual problem? Okay, so what I'm going to say now, I have something that was tight because I talked about them before. Let's see, the usual way is to measure the attackers, talking about QKD. We're looking at the key and the mutual information that the attacker has about the key is taken to be the usual measure. And now, this is, of course, this is entropy and so on. Well, they have operational meaning. I mean, Shannon, of course, introduces theory of communications. And Peter was referring to that decoding theorems and so on in 1948 in the DJ. And he has given the operational meaning to the quantities of light entropy or mutual information through the coding theorems. Why? Because the data rate and error rate, as you can say, are the operational quantities. That is, people can measure it. That has clear, definite empirical meaning. We are not talking about, we don't need to go into the fundamental meaning probability. At least in the relative frequency sense, that sense applies to communications, to ordinary communications, which is an objective definition. So data rate and error rates are the operational quantities. And entropy and mutual information, so what? So you have a probability distribution. You summarize it by one number. What's the meaning? And his coding theorems give you the meaning. So now, let's look at the use of entropy in cryptography. And Shannon himself, of course, has the same PSDJ paper in 1949. About the use of information theory in cryptography. And I have found it very misleading, this paper. I know he's revered as God in the academic circle, especially among electrical engineers. But what the problem is the following. He did not even discuss or mention the meaning. He used entropy throughout his paper as a measure of cryptographic, as some sort of measure of cryptographic security, without discussing its meaning. Now, when in the perfect case, it's okay. If something has n bit has n entropy equal to n, well, it has a clear meaning, or is it equal to zero? But what about if the n bit has an entropy of, you know, something in between? What would what does that mean in cryptography? He has no coding theorems or something, anything like that in cryptography. He does the same thing. He introduced the concept of Ulissity distance, which is roughly saying that the length at which the entropy hits zero or whatever point he doesn't talk about. And it's also a very misleading concept. You could see that actually in this book by, and even though some people thought that Shannon had, I mean, of course, he quantified at one time 10, that idea, that's relatively trivial. If you look at this big green book, I call, I mean, it's like the Bible by these two guys from the University of Waterloo, Van Stung, I don't remember the names. They have this big, big green book and no discussion of information theory. Shannon theory in cryptography. And only in one of the looks they mention it. Of course, everybody has to mention. So what is the significance of in this information theoretic security, so-called? I know that supposedly I have not a chance to look at it, especially issue in IT on information theoretic security. The point is, if it is not full or zero, what is the meaning of this security? Well, let's look at an n-bit sequence, say, the key you generate with the probability order in a certain way, E1, EM, that's E1 to be the biggest one. So you have a total to the 2 to the power n possible sequence. Let's assume that you know a fixed entropy. So the entropy of the system in a certain way, I want to know what is the maximum probability that you can guess what it is. Now you can easily show that if the attacker knows about n dot 2 to the minus l information, then the maximum probability that he can get, depending on the probability distribution, that means there is one, which will give 2 to the minus l. If you look at one, I pick some numerical example that is relevant to what people actually do in the laboratory, I mean, in trying to build a system. You can take n equal to 100, and people and the leak of information is 1. And then you will see that the maximum probability that he can have, there is a probability distribution for which the attacker can guess the whole key correctly with probability 0.01%. So the point is that if you want to guarantee anything, the important thing is the experimenters cannot really do better than so far 0.1%. It's OK, the mutual information is, if you look at it, if you use the mutual information criterion, if it's exponentially small, actually the exponent would be the actual number of PBs you generated. Then now, if you don't cannot get that cannot get the mutual information to be exponentially small, I mean, you need to ask experimentalists to do that to get to produce this guarantee. Then your proof that the mutual Yves information is only so and so gives a very weak guarantee in any real sense. That you, because you have not ruled out the possibility that he learns the key with a huge probability. And I don't know why that would be a significant guarantee if you don't, you have not achieved that. So I would say one suggestion that I made is to, let's use Yves trial complexity. That means on the average, if he can try again and again and again, how many times he needs to choose to do in order to get to unlock the key, for example. And it turns out that it's closely related to her maximum probability of guessing it. So it's basically, if it's 2 to the minus L, then the complexity goes up to as 2 to the L. On the other hand, the mutual information has a lot. It could lead a lot. So I would say that in cryptography, one needs to look at probability. One cannot just look at entropy at all. And the problem is not solved, of course, by using other criteria like the Kolmogorov distance or whatever, and the trace distance. And they're all the same as the neutral information. You need to make them exponentially small in order to make P1 small. And so this is the kind of numerical, different kinds of numerical guarantee. And I think there's this composability problem. There was more than a year ago in a piece of ref letter by Renner and Konglik or some of those people, another group, saying that one needs a different kind of criteria in terms of the trace distance of the density operator if you want it to compose a bit, to be secure under composition. And not only that, the same problem exists for that kind of criteria. Actually, I found that their conclusion why that one would solve the composability problem is not correct. That is, they make a jump in conclusion on a property that is not true generally. And in fact, I identified how they do it in another paper, that they say something about it, which they take the possibility of their exist as for everything. So the problem of it's like this case of the mutual information. The probability distribution bound, the difference between there exists and for every. There exists in a different form in this case. That is, if the attacker has so much entropy, there exists a probability distribution in which you know a lot. So proper cryptographic guarantee should work on Eve's probability of breaking the system. And instead of looking at the whole sequence of probabilities, the maximum one, P1, is good enough for almost any purpose I could see. So I think that's all from what I want to say. I think there are a lot more, but I already was not really explaining anything. And as I said, I'm just running through lots of things, and I hope some of them would hit on you and make it may sound interesting. And I'm here most of this 3 days, so I'm glad to talk to anybody about it. Thank you.
There's some questions. Well, if not, then let me point out two typographical errors in the program that are very embarrassing. One of them is that we are honoring Osamu. And the other embarrassing one for me particularly is that it says that Fuchs is speaking from 2:30 to 4:30. That is not correct. 2:30 to 3:25. So we have an hour and a half for lunch. Two and a half hours for lunch.
Well, 2 hours.
No, half an hour.
So
2 hours. 2 hours.